We're sitting in Studio 91, and when we have the Chief Executive Officer and the Chief Operating Officer, Kamal Medical Center, Dr. Chase, and Stephen Steak, who I like to call Dr. Stephen Steak, but he always says Stephen Steak. So here we are. And we're going to be talking about the situation and details about the COVID-19 and how they affect our community and what we're planning on keeping it as low as possible. So, Stephen, would you like to start? We're talking about how maybe we could talk about how did this come about?
Right. So here we are, and we're kind of in the middle of what seemingly chaos. A lot of people are, you know, tuned in to their TV screens and radios and trying to get some information. So I think our aim is just to give a little bit of a general idea of where we've come from and now where we are and where we're headed. As you were requesting to learn a little bit more at the start, it was originally known as novel coronavirus, and the outbreak started in Wuhan, China, and I think it was December 31st, in which the Chinese government alerted WHO, which stands for World Health Organization, that they had an outbreak there. And it was originally called novel coronavirus, and novel just means new. Coronavirus, corona is another word for crown, and so it just basically means a new virus that's shaped like a crown. That's what it looks like. And so as time progressed, they will name those novel viruses, and they'll give them a medical name. And so in this case, it's called COVID-19. The CO stands for the corona virus. The VI is the virus, and the D is disease, and then the 19 is 2019 in the year in which it came about. So that crossed over from an animal population. There's been speculation as to exactly where, whether it was bats, whether it was a meat market, or where exactly. That hasn't been affirmed like one way or the other, exactly where it came from and how it crossed over the human population. But that did occur in December, or roughly around December. WHO was alerted at the very tail end of December. And then as this has been spreading, you know, first it was within Wuhan, then it spread to other areas within China. Before you know it, it started crossing, you know, internationally. Some of the hardest hit areas originally were Iran and Italy. And then now, WHO just recently declared it a pandemic this last week, and basically means that it's spread almost everywhere. And it's now in over 100 countries. And here in the United States, the latest number is that we have over 2,200 affirmed positive cases. And just to give you an idea, that that's how many tests have actually demonstrated to be positive, but there's still most likely a lot more cases in the United States than what is showing positive on tests, and that's just because there's been a delay in getting tests out. Anytime there's a new virus, it takes a while for the system to catch up with having tests distributed and facilities being set up so that they can test for coronavirus. So here we are now, a few months later, and things have progressed quite a bit. You'll see that whenever the virus first hit the U.S., it really was hitting the more coastal regions, and that could be expected because a lot of the international travel hits your airports on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and so there's been larger outbreaks within the Northeast, whether it's New York area and along California. We had a large outbreak in the Washington area, and so now as these cases are getting to be more and more, the likelihood of there being, you know, more cases within Humboldt County is very likely, and that we would see something very soon. There has been one positive case within Humboldt County to date, and then there was a person of suspect, and those individuals were in right now to prepare to get all of our ducks in a row, whether it's the tribal governance, whether it's Kamau Medical Center, and all your different task forces to be able to do an appropriate response. And so I think we're doing well, and I, you know, commend council for moving forward and taking a lot of steps. It's pretty neat to see that we were more forward in our declaration, our emergency declaration, than Humboldt County was, and we've been one step ahead and trying to do preventative things to protect our people.
I'm glad you mentioned in your explanation about where it started is animals, possibility of that, but we don't know which.
Right.
So that's a little different than people.
Right. So, and there's speculation as to which animal probably. So most of the time those viruses stay separated and they don't, a host is basically an organism that carries a disease. So usually those viruses stay within a, you know, an animal population. And then every now and then there'll be a mutation or some sort of interaction between a human and an animal. I mean, we're animals of sorts, and that that'll be able to cross over into the human population and then spread across the human population.
In some of my interviews with Dr. Peavy, the veterinarian that does the spay and neuter clinics, and she was mentioning that too, how we need to pay more attention to the health of our animals. And because there is this crossover in the medical field and the veterinarian field are starting to acknowledge that, and that's what this whole thing is pointing at. And so, yeah, and then that's why some of the notices that we get say, wash your hands after you pet your animals or clean up after your animals. Yes. Who knows?
Sure, we're
pathogens.
We're tied into the same type of ecosystem, and certainly we know here how important our fish is and our water is, and we're all kind of in the same boat when things come this way.
Yeah, so then it makes no sense pointing fingers at populations, human populations, because that's not the point.
Yeah, we know that there's been some finger pointing. I think. I don't recommend finger pointing, but if you were going to point, essentially it's being smart about geographic regions at which something comes from and making sure that, you know, people here aren't traveling into like a known area of infection. So obviously, you know, within the United States now, if the Seattle, Washington area is a high area of infection where there's been an outbreak, then it would be a more preventative measure for, you know, our people not to be traveling there and then back and exposing the community at large to, you know, the risk of spreading that COVID-19 throughout this community. But certainly there's no indication that it's the virus is specific to any type of geographical boundary in the sense of a particular nationality or color of skin or any of those things. We don't have any indications that the virus is discriminating between what sort of people. The only discrimination of sorts is that, generally speaking, this doesn't mean that there aren't any cases within children, but generally speaking, that our children population are a little bit more resilient and protected. Thankfully, you know, our infants and children. And again, that doesn't mean that they cannot get COVID-19. It just means that they seem to be a little bit more resistant. And then our elder population seems to be a little bit more susceptible. And that whenever the symptoms are taken on, that our elder population and our population that has underlying health conditions, like such as chronic diseases or breathing issues, that they have a really tough time bouncing back, and a lot of times it could be severe, and really bad cases could be fatal.
That's what you mean by compromise, and a person might be compromised in their effects of contact and gathering.
Right, and maybe if Dr. Chase wants to add in on different types of chronic diseases and underlying conditions that make things hard to, you know, bounce back from.
Yeah, the most important is probably heart disease and heart-related problems, but there are other problems as well, even asthma or congestive heart failure or any kind of lung disorder is going to predispose you to infection. The infection seems to go right directly into the lungs. It rarely affects the sinuses. So that's why these people are at higher risk, because they tend to have more difficulty with their breathing to begin with. People that smoke a lot probably are at risk because of their smoking. And so those are the kind of things. But anybody with a chronic disease, diabetes, hypertension, is somewhat at higher risk than the younger people that don't have those problems.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So we're at the level right now, and I remember seeing you yesterday or at the whiteboard, and you were talking about this arch of the...
Yeah, so my background is public health, and so one of the things that you look at is how does some sort of outbreak affect the population. And so they have what they call like a pandemic curve. And so if you can kind of imagine that there's... it's hard to draw a diagram in the air, but I'll try to paint a picture a little bit. If you can just imagine that there's a few cases at the very beginning, and then as those few cases, they duplicate and they multiply. And so you once had one, now you got two. Now that two turned into six, and now those six people turned into 12, and you know the 12 maybe turned into 20. And as that replicates in that multiplication process, it means that there's now a lot of cases within your community, and then your health system can be overwhelmed. So what you try to do is, instead of having like this arch or this exponential multiplication within your community, you want to try to flatten that arch. You want to try to flatten the number of cases in your community and try to spread them out. So if you can imagine, say, for instance, say half of this community were to get COVID-19, what happens if they all get it at the same time? Your health system is completely overwhelmed. You don't necessarily have the money or the resources. You have people within homes that are, you know, overcrowded. You're trying to figure out how to get food. You have, you know, your governance and different officials who may be sick, you know, at the same time. And so the leadership is stressed. And then maybe your grocery store shelves are bare and those sort of things. All these things kind of happen at once. But the more that you can do to spread it out so that one person isn't giving it to three, but maybe they're just giving it to one other person. So if they're washing their hands, they're preventing going from like social gatherings and, you know, potentially coughing or shaking hands with another person, the more things that they do to prevent giving it to more people, and the more things that other people do to prevent themselves being exposed to it, the less that'll multiply within the community. So say, for instance, if there's a really slow transmission, so say one person gives it to one person, say the same number of people get it within that community, 50% of the people get it, but say you only have maybe 100 this month, 100 next month, 100 the next month, 100 the next month, instead of 1,000 the first month, you're going to be able to treat a whole lot more cases. Your health system won't be overwhelmed. People will be able to have time to put plans in place. They'll be able to rotate, you know, through the different work staff. The testing kits will get in place. The funds that come down from the federal government get appropriated to tribes to be able to buy protective equipment and sanitizer and cleaning agents for the schools and those sort of things. So that's all part of trying to flatten the curve, per se, and try to flatten this pandemic so that it doesn't become like one huge knockout punch, but it's just a few little punches here and there, and we can kind of keep moving forward through that.
Yeah, bob and weave, bob and weave.
There we go.
Yeah. So what kind of maneuvers are we doing? What steps are we taking?
Maybe Dr. Chase can cover the clinic steps, but I'll just talk about the community at large. I think one of the things that we've been working with council on and with the other entities, you know, as we're doing like strategic planning is like, one, this is a community thing. Like we're all in it together. So I think just understanding that we're all trying to protect the vulnerable populations, our elderly, and trying to protect each other. So it's kind of interesting for those of you who like the NBA and, you know, basketball. And there was an NBA player this past week, and on Monday, he ended up kind of making a mockery of coronavirus or COVID-19 and touching the microphones and doing all this stuff. And sure enough, 2 days later, he tests positive for COVID-19. Well, they suspect that it was him that spread COVID-19 to a teammate. And, you know, we also have the shutting down of the NBA season. And not to say that that was all his fault, but, you know, he came out a few days later after that and he's like, I am so sorry. So please use me as a case story of like carelessness and let people know that they need to be careful. So that's why I'm using Rudy Gobert's name. You know, for us, it's, you know, a lesson to be learned, you know, take this seriously. It doesn't mean, you know, be fearful, but it just means to be cautious, take it seriously. And, you know, if there's a way that you don't have to go out into the public and to a crowded place, don't do it. You know, if there's a way that you can go ahead and wash your hands or clean your hands before every meal or before every time you touch your face, you know, do those things to prevent you getting sick or passing it on. Try not to handshake. Just say, I'm sorry, I appreciate you or whatever it is. But, you know, give a thumbs up or do something else to indicate that you are appreciative of that person and you respect that person. But trying to stay at a safe social distance, and generally speaking, that's roughly around 6 feet. So you don't want to be around people who are, you know, coughing. They can possibly pass those droplets in the air. So there are different preventative measures we can do, cleaning those high-touch surfaces such as doorknobs or the remote control for those of us who like to sit on the couch and watch stuff and pass it on to the next family member. You can also, you know, wipe down the door handle to your car, or there's so many high touch places. If you can just like think about it a little bit of like, what are the areas in my house, in my home, or in my workplace that everybody else is touching or that I'm frequently touching, whether it's your computer, your keyboard, all those sort of things.
Coffee pots.
Yeah, we just had a meeting yesterday and we got some stuff from the National Federation for Community Broadcasters. And so we're cleaning these screens on these microphones, mm-hmm. and all of our computer mice and all of the other equipment that we all commonly use all the time. Even the temperature gauge, those little buttons that we push to see what the high and the low is. Clean those off, wipe those off with a towel.
All of those things can make a difference. You know, our kids out there who are listening, you know, go home, help, whether it's your mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, or, you know, whoever you're with, help them clean the house a little bit and, you know, touch up on them doorknobs and try to keep things clean and protect each other. And I think that's the message that we're sending out, is that a lot of this will be, as a tribe, we're doing preparations to come up with our emergency response plans, but it really takes each person in the community, because really all it takes is, you know, just a few people who do travel into an infected area and coming back and not washing their hands, and it can be replicated pretty quick. I think that there's a case in South Korea where I believe it was a church member of sorts, and I guess they had had contact with a lot of church members, and I mean, possibly over 100 people were infected by one person. So the more that we can do to be knowledgeable to not replicate in that sort of way, but keep it as minimal as possible, those type of interactions and those the touching, the better off that we'll be. And we realize people may not have, you know, a super large home with like multiple rooms. And the idea is that there's not a perfect solution, but there are really good opportunities to be able to hold things back and to be able to prevent the spread.
There was the last Wednesday we had that meeting up, and there's the whole PowerPoint presentation, and there's some samples of cleaning fluids that were presented. And then you go to the store and you can't find them. Mm. So could we talk about homemade type of things if you want to go there?
I mean, we can. Generally speaking, I would just say be safe. I'm not the all-knowing person on all of the home agents. But generally speaking, if you don't have hand sanitizer, use warm water and soap and wash your hands frequently and do it for at least 20 seconds. So if you can sing your favorite song all the way through and wash your hands, then you'll probably be in pretty good condition for getting all of the virus off your hands and other germs. And as far as like cleaning your home, you know, obviously any sort of cleaning is better than no cleaning. If you have something that is, you know, alcohol based, then there are possibilities to, you know, use that. You can use soap and water, but as far as for killing viruses, as you mentioned, that there are certain products and you'd want to look on those products to see if they're antiviral, you know, antibacterial. For COVID-19, it would be, antiviral. And if there aren't those agents available, there are agents such as, your bleach. But you would have to be very, very careful. You don't want to just go wiping everything down with a full solution of bleach and, you know, kind of the exposure that puts people to. You'd have to be very careful about mixing that and making sure that it's heavily diluted. And I've heard, you know, like a cap full, you know, essentially for a gallon or, you know, something that's less than like a 1-to-10 ratio. Like in the sense of you don't want to have half bleach and half water. That's way, way, way too strong. So just put a little bit of a dab of, you know, bleach in there and mix it with water, and then you can go ahead and clean some of those high touch surfaces with that. Again, that's not official per se, because that's, you know, we recommend something that's like EPA approved for like an antiviral within like the clinic. We have certain accreditations that we have to follow and certain cleaning procedures at the clinic, but in general at home, you know, if people are having trouble finding that information, we'll put out another PSA on different type of cleaning agents. I don't know if you want to add anything on that, Dr. Chase.
Well, the main thing is doing the cleaning, and we at the medical center hired additional staff to do extra cleaning, especially during busy hours of the day. Usually our housekeepers work mostly in the evenings and after hours to clean, but now we have cleaners during the day, so that's hopefully helping to diminish the risk.
Well, I brought that up also in connection with the hand sanitizers that we heard about that are at the Senior Nutrition Center, but those are for the elders, from what I understand, because of the population threats.
Correct. We know that we're in a shortage as of right now, and everything's on back order. So we're trying to put the hand sanitizers and the cleaning agents that we have available for those like high encounter areas, as well as for the most vulnerable populations.
Yeah, it makes sense. And anything else that we're doing, or any other measures that we're looking at?
Do you want to talk about the clinic a little bit, Dr. Chase?
Well, at the clinic, we're doing drills where the staff actually are preparing to test people so that they are very confident in using the equipment to protect themselves and knowing how to do the swabs. And we've had video trainings for some of the staff that they can watch how to do it. And we actually had people do it. Actually, Stephen was our guinea pig. He came in as a patient, walked in, and we went through the drill of how we would process this patient that came in with the fever and coughing and had travel issues that made them high risk. So, and we're planning on doing those drills until everybody's really comfortable to continue to do that, because based on the staff that we have available to do the work, they're all going to be trained, actually. So, and then the other thing, we recently set up testing outside the main clinic so that we don't expose the population in the lobby of the clinic or in the clinic rooms when they come in for regular care, chronic care issues. So, and hopefully we can limit the exposure to all of our other patients as much as possible.
Yeah, I understand you're using the KIDE emergency broadcast unit.
Yes, we just...
Are you opening up the back?
So, yeah,
so because there's that larger area, of empty area there.
Right, so we are planning to use that as it becomes, you know...
Yeah, and it's self-contained, it's almost like a home.
Yeah, we're just going to plug in the electricity, and it has water tanks and has a generator itself, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. It's got a shower in it, too.
Yeah, bathroom. So people can self-isolate in there until we get advice from the county on what the next step would be based on what information we give them.
Yeah, that was good buy when we got that grant. Put that in there for an emergency services.
Well, thank you.
Worked just fine. All right. We broadcast. You could broadcast out of that too, you know, just throwing that transmitter.
And you did bring up an interesting point earlier about like kind of the questions about testing. So just for clarity's sake, the testing that we do at the clinic, we have essentially kit to where, as Dr. Chase mentioned, we can do a nasal and a throat swab. And then that kit is actually sent out. So we don't get the results directly at Kamau Medical Center within, you know, just an hour or so. It's actually a longer process to where we have that kit. We send it out to the coast, they process it, and then we hear back. And so it could take, you know, maybe up to 48 hours because they only have so much capacity out on the coast. And I know that there's been a lot of efforts to have like more of a rapid testing type of opportunity, and hopefully we'll be able to get some of that here in Humboldt County, and even hopefully at, you know, Kamau Medical Center. So there are efforts being made, one, to get out more testing to the community at large or across the United States. And so I think it was around 4 million testing kits that they were trying to get out to all the clinics. But then the other effort is to have like a rapid testing ability so that you could have something that wouldn't take so long. So the test itself takes at least 4 hours to be able to process, but then you have like a backlog of other people who need tests, so you may not hear back, you know, for quite a while. So it may take some time to find out the results. And that's, but it kind of leads into another area too, that even testing is important, but at the same time, like a lot of the measures for testing and waiting are fairly similar. So like if you are sick and you feel like you need testing for coronavirus, you should, even if you don't have it, you should be calling the clinic, setting an appointment, letting them know ahead of time that you're displaying symptoms, and so that way they can prepare and be ready and help you through the questions that you may have, and then determine whether you should receive testing or not. Even if you aren't positive, say for instance for COVID-19, but you're displaying, you know, symptoms of cough or cold, you know, or flu, those sort of things, we don't need those things circulating within our community. And that's why we've been trying to really communicate that if you're sick, stay home. You know, if your child's sick, or whoever you have guardianship over, if they're sick, then don't bring them to school. Keep them home, and you can stay home with them. And I know that the chairman has taken supportive measures to be able to provide, I guess you say, like if you're a tribal employee, to be able to have that compensation for emergency leave in these type of cases.
Back at that Wednesday PowerPoint presentation, I informed all the managers, there was a comment made that if you hold your breath, take a deep breath and hold it, to do like your own self-test. And if you take a deep breath and hold it, and you feel pain in your chest, or you have this sensation that you need to cough, then you just might want to be tested. Is that correct?
I heard something similar to that, and that was based on the experience in China. They were saying in China that if you get too symptomatic, it gets too late to intervene and do something early. And so that was a method of, I guess, pre-screening before they actually tested people, was whether they could hold their breath for 10 seconds. If they couldn't, then they would test them.
That's a good thing. Now, I think that would relieve a lot of people and thinking, well, there might be, you know, my child has a fever and we'll have them hold their breath.
Yeah, we're kind of learning a lot from the China experience as well as the Italy experience, as a lot of the information is evolving there much quicker than it is right now in the U.S. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting to understand is that, you know, we're almost at the back end of this, seems like. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I guess in a weird good way that there are other countries that have are a little bit further into dealing with this pandemic, and we can learn from what they've been learning along the way, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel, so to say. We can move forward and learn from everything that they're experiencing, because it is new, and that's the whole idea, the novel coronavirus. It's new, so we're having to issue guidance and kind of come up with some procedures on the fly as we learn more and more about the virus itself. And whenever we look back at kind of like the pandemic planning, so the tribe has pandemic planning, and you kind of have the skeletal plans of what you know that you need to do as a tribe to prepare, to get people ready, communications, prep of the different entities. But then you add that muscle on the bone, like as you find more and more about what type of pandemic it is, and you incorporate the different type of procedures and information that's needed as you learn more.
Yeah, best practices, yeah.
Maybe we could just reemphasize one more time that if you suspect that you might have COVID-19, like if you've been in a high-risk area or been around someone who has been known to have COVID-19 and you know, you're experiencing those type of symptoms, just please call the clinic so that we can prepare before you come in. Worst case scenario, if there's no way for you to call, then we have a big doorbell. It's pretty amazing. So when you come up to the clinic and there's a big, we call it a sandwich board out front that has information pertaining to COVID-19, and you'll see signs that say, you know, put on a mask. So if people are displaying symptoms, please put on, you know, a mask. And if you are displaying symptoms, basically, and you can't call ahead of time, there's no way for you to do that, go ring the big doorbell. It's just to the right of the glass doors. And then that way it alerts our staff inside that somebody needs to come in from, come out from the inside and be able to do an assessment on a patient. And so that way we're trying to do all that we can. It's not, how do you say, at the end of the world, if a person with symptoms comes into the clinic, we'll do a thorough cleaning job and do everything that we can to make sure that that infection doesn't spread. But at the same time, we want to try to do everything that we can to keep infection away from our vulnerable populations. So if we have vulnerable populations who, as Dr. Chase outlined, different people with underlying conditions that are coming into the clinic because they need treatment, they need medication, they need a consultation with their provider, we want to make sure that, you know, our lobby and our patient rooms and all those areas don't have COVID-19 in them. And so if we can assess while people are in their car or outside or in the new KIDE RV we've got parked on the side, if we can do that outside of the clinic, all the better, because it just reduces the chance of spreading that infection.
Precautions, yes. Flatten that curve.
Yes, flatten the curve. I guess maybe some of the other things that you mentioned about flatten the curve, there's been a lot of questions about isolation and kind of what that entails, or, you know, how to prepare. So I believe that the The chairman's memo did talk about preparing for staying at home for a considerable amount of time, for maybe a few weeks. So if you do have the ability to get some non-perishable items and keep them within your home so that you can have them there should you get infected or a family member be infected, then, you know, we'd encourage you to do that. At the same time, we are planning on, you know, our side, we realize that it may be hard to purchase food and to be able to make some of those preparations, it may be hard. So we'll do what we can on our end to be able to provide for the community in those type of emergency situations. But again, we'd encourage people to, you know, grab some rice or grab some dry beans or, you know, some canned goods or things that aren't gonna spoil, you know, in a matter of just a couple days. So that way you have them on hand. And if you end up not using them for this pandemic, you can always use them later on in the year and eat them up. So go ahead and do that. There's also been recommendations that if you have like, you know, a window in your home or a door connected to the outside, open it up every once in a while to, you know, let that air flow throughout so it's not so stuffy in your home. You know, wipe down the high touch points and surfaces. And you were actually joking a little bit before we came in that you were getting your sunlight and getting your vitamin D. And so I'm not a medical provider, but at the same time that we are kind of at the tail end of winter. And so a lot of people are vitamin D deficient because they get that from the sunlight. And so if you've been inside all winter and you may be a little bit vitamin D deficient, and that certainly does help out your immune system a lot. And so maybe a daily dose. We're not talking about somebody taking a ton of vitamin D. Consult your physician or provider. Talk to them if you have any questions. But taking a low dosage of vitamin D might be a smart thing to do. Do you want to add anything about that, Dr. Chase?
No, I agree. In the past, the medical patients that we've tested, about, you know, 99% of them were always low at this time of year in particular because of the lack of sunlight in this area.
And again, another question that we've gotten is on treatment. So right now, there's not a specified treatment for, there's not a cure for COVID-19, but there are treatments, and that'll be determined by, you know, a provider. So essentially, you let the virus run its course, but if you have, like, fever or chills or you're coughing, those are symptoms of the actual COVID-19, and I don't know if you want to add in how you, if you were to have a case, maybe how you treat some of the symptoms, even if you don't have a cure per se for COVID-19.
Yeah, the symptoms, usually sometimes we have to give breathing treatments for patients. And of course, that would be an example of how we would treat some of the breathing difficulty or using inhalers in patients that haven't used inhalers in the past, but because of the respiratory issues, they can use inhalers. So there's methods of treating some of the symptoms like that. Of course, the fever, you know, taking the anti-inflammatories or acetaminophen is a good idea. But, depending on the situation. I think the other important thing is people stay well hydrated during this situation because whenever you have infection, your blood pressure just goes all over the place. Sometimes it goes high, sometimes it goes low. But if you stay well hydrated, it will help a lot probably in protecting you.
Yeah, water is very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Water is life.
Very good.
Yeah, and the only other question I can think of off the top of my head is people are always asking, well, what about a vaccine or what about a cure? So just to give you a little bit of a timeline, vaccines take a while to develop, and the reason why they take a while is, one, you have to study the virus itself or whatever the infection is, and then you have to see kind of how it replicates, what what sort of mechanisms it uses, you know, within the body, within the host. And so they take all these things into consideration. And before rolling out a vaccine, you would first see if it would work on a cellular level. And then if it works there, you'd look and see if it works within an animal population, so rodents, and as it progresses, maybe, you know, primates or, you know, monkeys or that sort of thing. And then you would do some sort of like individual type of trials to test for safety, and then a larger group, and then you'd have to see about the results. So it takes a long time for vaccine because they want to make sure that it's safe before giving it to the public, and they don't want to rush that process. So realistically, you don't have vaccines before a year's time. So again, vaccines are to prevent the actual infection and to build up immunity within your body to prevent it. On the backside of it, the treatment or the cure, it usually will be a little bit quicker of a process than developing a vaccine. So they may be able to come out with a cure per se, or a treatment for the virus of how to break it down or how to stop it once you actually have the infection. They're probably going to be a little bit more quicker with that process, but we're still looking at, you know, at least a few months. But I know that there are a lot of different pharmaceutical companies and different folks that are trying to come up with different ways in which to treat the actual COVID-19. And so we may be a little bit closer to a treatment than we are to an actual vaccine that would be rolled out to the population. So again, that kind of takes us back to flattening the curve. Everything that we can do to delay the rampant spread within the community, it will put us closer on that timeline to the development of a cure that could possibly be given to the community at large, and then further on down, like having some sort of vaccine that could be rolled out.
Okay, that explains the difference between a vaccine and a cure. Yeah. Yeah, didn't exactly understand it myself. That's nice. So the season's going to change. Is that going to help any?
We don't know. Yeah, we don't know yet. Yeah. It really is unknown whether it's going to, there's an ebb and flow, kind of like you have your influenza of, you know, during the winter, and how it tends to wane off during the summer months and the heat. There isn't that information available since it's a new virus. So, I mean, obviously we hope for the best, but there's not really an indication that that will happen.
As the weather improves, people will be outdoors more, so that may help to decrease the transmission, as well as people will be opening their doors and opening their windows and getting air circulation, whereas they've been closed up all winter long type of thing.
Yeah, with those fires going, the smoke. Yeah. Yeah.
So when's the first day of spring?
20th.
The 20th. So the thing that pops into my mind is spring cleaning, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Spring cleaning.
All right, so maybe we can do a little bit of a spring cleaning effort across the community and get all those touch points cleaned off and do it frequently.
Starts now. Very good. Well, that was a discussion about COVID-19 and our preparations and how we're going to cure ourselves. So thank you very much, Dr. Chase, Dr. State.
Thank you.
Thanks.